This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and to the Big Picture. Today, Jim has a guest on the Big Picture, Dr. Gary Schilling, under discussion his book, The Age of Deleveraging.
Well, it seems perplexing. Every single year, the economists come out and make projections that economic growth will be better this year than the previous year, only to reduce those forecasts as the economy in the year progresses. What has happened to 3 and 4% growth rates? They're no longer with us. The economy is growing more in an anemic 2%. The forecasts for economic growth and even inflation have gone awry at the Federal Reserve. Joining me on the program is A. Gary Schilling. He's author of the book, The Age of Deleveraging, which we featured on Friday's premium channel. And he's also the editor of Insight. Gary, let's begin with what happened after the Great Recession, probably one of the deepest recessions this country has experienced. The only one that came back to mind would be the maybe 73-74 recession. But there's been a lot of reasons why maybe fiscal policy has been ineffective. QE is not very effective. You believe the result of this anemic economic growth is the result of working off excess financial leverage that was built up over a widespread basis between, let's say, the 80s, 90s, and perhaps the last decade.
Yeah, that's certainly my thesis. And that's what this book, The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation, is a subtitle. That's the whole thesis of the book, that we had huge, huge excess borrowing, financial leverage, if you will, by the consumer sector in this country, financial institutions on a global basis, a lot of other areas, emerging markets, China most recently. It's a matter of working off that excess leverage. And what's fascinating about this is that despite all the huge, huge fiscal stimuli that we had initially in response to the Great Recession, you remember in 2009, we had the tax cuts and rebates and huge spending programs, and that was the equivalent of 6% of GDP in this country, and it was twice as big, 12%, in relation to the Chinese economy in China. Despite that, and then despite all the monetary attempts, bailing out Wall Street, and then the quantitative easing, in effect buying massive amounts of securities by the Federal Reserve. They completed that program at the end of 14, but the Eurozone and the Bank of Japan are still. Despite all that, we have a slow growth. And what it says to me is that these deflationary forces are so robust that they simply have swamped all these attempts to restore growth with massive monetary and fiscal stimuli.
You know, academic studies show, and I think of Rogoff's book, This Time It's Different, that after major binges of financial leverage, much like we saw in the last decade, it takes about a decade of deleveraging and resulting slow growth to work off these excesses. We're, what, year nine into a 10-year cycle. You believe that perhaps this is going to be a more extended cycle, that we may have another 6 to 8 years to go before leverage ratios return to earlier norms. Gary, that almost implies something similar to what Japan has been going through for almost two decades.
Well, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I had that decade as a subtitle of this book, but as you stated, we're 9 years into it, and at the rate we're going, it's going to take another 6 to 8 years just to get back to normal levels of leverage. Let me give you one example. Household debt in this country, and this is mortgage debt, second mortgages, student loans, credit cards, auto loans, almost anything that's legal. You look at that in relation to after-tax income. It used to be 65%. 65% of after-tax income was debt. In the early 80s, it started to run up. It got up to 130%. It's now down to 103%. In other words, it's a long way from that 65% norm. If you just take a ruler and look at the rate of decline, the working down of this excess debt, it'll take another 6-8 years to get back to that norm. And I'm a great believer in reversion to trends when they were as long established as they were in that case.
Now, one thing that we saw economic growth really pick up in the last decade with the emergence of, let's say, the emerging markets, the growth of China, China moving to the second largest economy in the world, and part of that was globalization. You believe that the process of globalization over the last three decades or so is pretty much complete, and that this massive shift of production of goods to overseas, that has spent itself. In other words, there are no more places to go to shift production. Much of that has already played out. That has enormous implications for organizations like the IMF and World Bank that keep looking at world growth to pick up. It's just not happening. Is it because globalization has peaked?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, globalization, I think, is the biggest global economic phenomenon of the last three decades. And by that, of course, we're talking about the movement of production, largely manufacturing, from Europe and North America to these developing countries, China first and foremost, but many, many others, you know, Taiwan, South Korea, the whole host of them. And that process gave them tremendous growth. Now, it wasn't world growth. It wasn't domestic growth. It was simply that they looked much bigger than they really were domestically because of this movement of manufacturing to these countries. Well, that process is all over. If you look, for example, at manufacturing as a percentage of GDP in this country, if you go back to the 1990s, it was 17%. Now, that declined pretty steadily to 12%, but in the last 4 or 5 years, it's leveled off. In other words, we've gotten down to that irreducible minimum. Everything that could be transferred to China and elsewhere has been. So that's over. So that source of growth from globalization is over. The other thing that happened that pushed growth in China particularly was massive, massive overinvestment in infrastructure and housing and so on. And of course, the result of these ghost cities, excess capacity, underutilized railroads, highways, factories, etc., and massive debt. Chinese debt in relation to the economy has almost doubled since 2007. And that's caused problems in China. So those sources of growth are basically over. But I think the important thing here is that many people thought that China and these other countries were growing independently. They even hoped that they would somehow, their growth would spill over to the West. Well, that's got it completely backwards. Their growth was basically led by exports. And where do the exports go? The exports go to North America and Europe. And with slow growth in North America and in Europe, and the end of this globalization process, you simply do not have the growth potential of those countries anymore.
You know, we've seen this also in this economic recovery and market recovery, where companies, rather than build, let's say, invest a new plant and equipment, it's been a lot of financial engineering, either buying back their stock, refinancing their debt, doing arbitrage between buying back stock and dividends. I think of Intel a couple of years ago issuing debt at 1.6%, retiring stock with dividends at 4%. So companies have either gone out and bought other companies, or they've bought back stock rather than invest in, let's say, building new plants. And I guess, Gary, one of the reasons they're probably not building new plants, the demand isn't there.
You're absolutely right. And if you want to look at where does the financial engineering start, it started with the Federal Reserve. I mean, their massive buying of securities, quantitative easing, pumped this money into the economy. Where did it go? A lot of it went into equities. So we've had this very strong rally in stocks starting in March of 2009. And the Federal Reserve was bailing out Wall Street and then moved on to quantitative easing, as they called it. And, of course, they discontinued that at the end of 2014. And guess what? Stocks are flat last year, and they've declined so far this year. I think it shows that that was what was supporting it, was financial engineering officially by the Fed. The problem was that when they pumped that money out, people bought stocks because they were selling the Fed Treasury obligations. They had the money. What they do with it? A lot of it went into equities. Well, equities are held by higher income people, and they don't tend to spend a lot more money as their portfolios go up, as their assets increase. In other words, somebody's got three cars in a driveway. He hasn't got room for a fourth one, even though he's got more assets. So it never really got beyond that financial engineering, if you will. It did not get down to spurring the economy, to creating spending on goods and services and jobs and the kind of normal recovery. And that's why we've had this really half-speed recovery. We've been limping along 2.1% growth so far in this expansion. That's what I had forecast in this book written in 2010. I said it would be 2%. It is so far. And that's about half of what you'd expect after the most severe recession since the 1930s.
I want to talk about two phenomena that are adding to this weaker economic growth. And let's begin with the price of oil. With the price of oil down 30%, then down another 70%, actually touching into the 20s. I want to get to oil later on. But there was this massive saving somewhere in the neighborhood of $74, $75 billion. The U.S. being a consumer-led economy with consumption about 70% of GDP, economists were predicting that this spillover of savings from gasoline would translate into consumer spending. Gary, in your latest insight, you're talking about that's not what happened. It actually went into savings.
Yeah, that's correct. And there's a lot of reasons for that. As a matter of fact, we keep running these data every month as we get new evidence. But if you look at the huge windfall from lower gasoline costs with the collapse in oil and gasoline prices, people have saved it all and then some. They didn't go out and spend it on other goods and services. I mean, since November of 2014, and that's right before OPEC decided not to cut production and oil prices went off the cliff, people have actually, they have had $82 billion in increase windfall from this, but they've saved even more than that. Their savings has gone up 85%. Well, why are they saving? Well, it's normal for people to save in tough times. If you look at recessions, you say, well, there are conflicting forces there. People want to save for tough times, but they have less income to do so. In recessions, what wins out? The desire to save more. Even though they don't have a lot of money, they save more. And so we're seeing that. And then also, you have very strong reasons to save. The post-war babies, for example, notoriously poor savers. And a lot of those folks now, they are actually working longer than you would expect at their ages because they have no choice. They've really got to work because they simply do not have the assets to retire. So there's a lot of reasons why the saving is going up. And of course, if people are saving more, their spending is growing more slowly than their incomes. It's a reversal of what happened during this big increase in debt that I mentioned earlier. The saving rate was declining from 12% in the early 80s to 2%. Consumer spending and the economy was growing 0.5% a year faster than it would have been had people not been, in effect, digging into their saving to finance spending growth faster than their incomes.
Yeah, that's a phenomenon that we've seen in the area of retirement planning, where a lot of the boomers, number one, they probably didn't save as much in the 90s when the savings rate really went down. I mean, you didn't have to save. The market was doing it for you. It was going up double digits a year. So we've had two bear markets, including one in real estate. So boomers are staying in the workforce, which is affecting job growth. But also, Gary, let's talk about the millennials, because a lot of millennials have racked up huge amounts of student debt, you know, and I forget what the figure is. You probably have a better handle on this, where the average millennial couple getting married today could bring up to $70,000 of student loan debt into a marriage. You add car loans on top of that. And the implication of this is you're not seeing this transform itself into new home buyers. So let's talk about also the younger generation and the implications for consumption.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in our February newsletter, Insight, which is just out, we have an article on this. And what's interesting is we've had this tremendous rush into rentals. People are renting because they don't have the credit scores. They got the student loan debts. They don't have the job security. So they're renting rather than buying houses. Well, the response to that has been tremendous building of apartment buildings. And of course, earlier, a lot of single family foreclosed houses were in effect converted to rentals. It wasn't just mom and pops. It was major financial institutions doing that. So what we're developing right now, there's a gap between the cost of renting and the cost of buying. Renting is more expensive. But I think that we're probably going to see more interest in buying houses, a little more job security as time goes on. But the overbuilding in the multifamily, in the apartment area, is probably going to retard those prices. So this gap will probably get closed. But at the moment, it's actually cheaper to buy a house than it is to rent one.
Since the economy is made up of 70% consumption, we just talked about what is impacting the boomers. They're staying in the workforce. They're working longer. They're not retiring as earlier. The millennials aren't spending as much. They're more apt to be renters, and that has implications for furniture, all kinds of other sales. Let's talk about two other inputs into the economy. One is business investment and the other is government spending, because a lot of governors across this country are reducing expenditures, enforcing state employees to take reductions in their pension benefits. So that means more money is being allocated to pensions versus other forms of spending. And then let's talk about the corporate side, because one of the things that I've seen every year in terms of forecasts made for the economy, well, this is the year that capital expenditures or CapEx picks up for business. We haven't seen it.
No, we haven't. And it's really a matter of excess capacity. That's the primary driver historically. And also you have the uncertainty with government regulation and so on and so forth. The one area where capital spending has been strong is anything that can cut costs, promote productivity, because we have not seen, in terms of driving corporate profits, the normal increase in revenues in this recovery. You haven't had the unit volume growth. And of course, with virtually no inflation, there's no pricing power, ability to raise prices. So American business has really created profits by cutting costs. And ultimately, all of those are labor costs. That's why real incomes, in other words, adjusted for inflation, they've been flat in this whole recovery. But the point is that the spending that has taken place there by business has been to promote productivity, to cut costs one way or the other. As far as governments, state and local governments, you know, it's one of these deals. A lot of governments found it all too easy to hand out these lush pension benefits in past decades because they weren't going to be paid until decades later. And I don't know whether people consciously thought about this. Maybe I'm being cynical, but I think it was kind of after me the deluge. I'm not going to have to worry about paying it. I'll be long out of office, retired, or whatever by then. But these huge pension costs are there, and it is forcing states to address this, to require people to work longer, to cut benefits, particularly for new hirees, to convert from this defined benefit pension plan, sort of the old type of pension plan that guaranteed people so much a month for life, to what's called defined contribution. These are the 401ks, where what is available for retirement is pretty much the result of the investment results that the individual employee has a lot of control over.
So we're seeing basically a pullback in many ways of spending. With the boomers, they just don't have the assets there. As you mentioned, a lot of the savings that economists were expected from the reduction in gasoline prices did not go into the economy. It went into savings as people sort of want to build up assets, pay down debt. Let's talk about other avenues of growth. And I want to go back to the last decade, where the emerging markets, especially led by China, was a driving force, and especially for the consumption of commodities. As we look at China today, China's official economic numbers are 6.5, and I don't think anybody really believes those numbers.
No, I sure don't. I sure don't.
Yeah, I mean, those are more political numbers, it seems like. But let's talk about China, because you have a theory, and I want to get into that right now, that China has probably seen its best days. And much like Japan, you know, I think when I first met you in the 80s, Gary, we were all worried about Japan, that Japan was going to buy up assets. They were buying up Rockefeller Center, Pebble Beach. There were books out on Japanese style management, and we were all going to go work for Japanese companies. And the same was said in the last decade, where China went from nothing to becoming the second largest economy in the world, that China was going to take over and literally surpass the United States. You think that China could experience a similar road, or go down the similar road of Japan? It has an aging population. They ran into problems with their one-child policy. Now they've lifted that to two. But even if Chinese start having babies, you know, you're talking about a couple decades before that's going to impact the economy.
That's right. And the labor force. Yeah. You know, my favorite example of this is files that I keep. I still have files of newspaper clippings and reports. I'm antediluvian in that regard. But back in the 80s, and you and I were just talking about, you mentioned this, I used to have literally feet of files on Japan and maybe an inch or two or China. Now I've got an inch or two on Japan and feet on China. And I think we may go back the other way with China, because as we talked earlier, China was really growing because of globalization, the movement of production from Europe and North America to China. And then China was, that production was used to produce exports. And where did the exports go? They went to North America and Europe. Well, you've got slow growth in those areas. So if you have slow growth, they're not demanding as much of anything, including Chinese imports from China. And the other thing was this massive excess capacity building, housing, ghost cities, and so on and so forth. So I think that we probably are going to look on China as not the end of the world, but we're going to realize that China is an underdeveloped country. The GDP per capita in China is only 14% of the U.S. In other words, it's big because it's got a lot of people. It's got 1.3 billion people. It's not because it is a developed country. And right now, they're trying to convert from this export-led economy, economy driven as well by infrastructure spending, all this excess capacity as a result. They're trying to convert to more service and consumer-oriented economy. Now, one of the things that that's going to do, and it already is dramatically reduce the demand for commodities. Because if it's a manufacturing economy and you're manufacturing these products that are going to Western Europe and U.S., you're using a lot of commodities. You're using a lot of iron ore, a lot of copper, a lot of coal, you name it. And China was, for a number of years, they were absorbing about 45% of the world's annual production of tin, lead, zinc, copper, all these non-ferrous metals, huge amounts of coal, stockpiling oil, all these kinds of things. Well, that's pretty much over. So I think we're looking at a very different animal. And one of the fascinating things is that Japan, even though Japan has had virtually no economic growth for two decades, and they've had deflation more years than they've not, Japan is still a very wealthy country. It's a very high income per capita. But China, again, 14% of the U.S. GDP per capita, China is the only major country that's going to grow old before it grows rich.
You know, last summer, when China devalued its currency, and let's talk about currencies here and the implications of what may happen going forward with China, they were pegging their currency to the U.S. dollar. As a result of the dollar rising against other major currencies, and I think that's a trend you still think will continue, their currency rose against its trading partners, so they devalued, I think it was something like 3%. They've used quite a bit of their reserves to maintain it. You think they will devalue further, but they may do it in indirect ways. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, China still has a 14% disadvantage against their major trading partners because they basically earlier linked their currency to the dollar. Interestingly, they were trying to show that they were responsible people. They wanted to be included in the International Monetary Fund's list of reserve currencies, and that's a pretty rarefied group. It's the dollar, British sterling, the euro, and the Japanese yen. And they did get that nod of approval last December, and that really, and I think, said to them, hey, we can now can devalue with gay abandon. But I think, you know, they're doing it in a number of ways. One is because if they devalue explicitly, and they did that last summer, but it's resulted in a huge outflow of money from China. Now, China had $4 trillion in foreign currency reserves, but they've spent $700 billion of them so far, in effect, trading dollars for yuan, their currency, for people who want to leave. In other words, somebody wants to leave. If they didn't, in effect, give them the dollars to take out, to cart away, their currency would collapse. So they don't want to explicitly devalue because of huge currency outflows and the chaos in the financial markets. What they're doing other things. It's more subtle. One of the things they're doing is internal devaluation. In other words, if you reduce wages, you can then reduce the prices of exports, and that makes them more attractive. And that's the ultimate goal, is to make exports more attractive to spur the domestic economy. But the other way you're alluding to, Jim, is linking their currency to this basket of currencies. And they're all devaluing against the dollar. Everybody in the world is devaluing against the dollar. So China can simply float down with these other currencies. And then they say, well, we're not devaluing against the dollar. Well, they really are, because they're just joining the crowd of all these other countries as they knock down their currencies against the greenback.
Let's talk about what this means also for commodities, because we saw a real bull market in commodities in the 70s. Of course, that was coming after the Vietnam War. We saw it again in the last decade with the emergence of China. You did a study and point out that usually commodity inflation has been more associated with periods of war than, per se, let's say, economic development. Talk about that, because at least currently, we're not at a war where we're firing bullets and dropping bombs everywhere as we were, let's say, in Vietnam or the Korean War or World War II.
Well, that's right. And one of my favorite charts, which we've used very frequently in our monthly newsletter, Insight, shows commodity prices adjusted for inflation going back to 1749. Now, I'm not sure about 1748, but at least from 1749 on, and a lot of this, of course, is academic studies. There wasn't official data back there. But what it shows is that commodity prices adjusted for inflation have been on a steady downtrend since the mid-1800s. And there are these punctuations, spikes that you alluded to, war, civil war, World War One, World War Two, the oil embargoes in the 1970s. But other than that, it's been a steady downturn trend. And that's amazing because you think of what's happening in this period. You've had tremendous use of commodities. For example, late 1800s, the American Industrial Revolution was in full flower. That used all kinds of commodities. Railroads were being developed the same. Japan went through forced industrialization in the last few decades of the 1800s. Again, huge commodity uses. And yet they declined. What it says to me is that shortages never really hold up, that human ingenuity beats shortages any day. Sure, there's only so much copper in the world's surface. There's only so much iron ore, coal, et cetera, natural gas, oil. But we find more and more ways of getting out. Oil is interesting, of course, because, you know, OPEC is, you know, and this is another topic, but I think OPEC is basically in it. It finishes a cartel. And we're seeing a huge development of this hydraulic fracking. Fracking in the U.S. is really becoming the center of energy production and ultimately the controller of price. But again, OPEC didn't realize that. They thought they had a stranglehold here. And what do you find? Human ingenuity beats shortages any time. Always has. I think always will.
That leads me to the next topic, which is OPEC and oil. And I can remember doing an interview of you last year where you talked about $20 oil and possibly 10. And quite honestly, I was even struck with a bit of disbelief at the time because we were undergoing a rally where oil got back up into the 50s. They were hoping it would get up to the 60s. But last month, we touched down into the 20s. So let's talk about a very important decision that was made on December 27th, 2014, when OPEC decided not to cut its oil production and OPEC failed to agree on production costs despite intervening collapse in oil prices. Let's talk about this sea change and what it may mean, if possible, the end of OPEC.
That decision was because OPEC was getting tired of, in effect, cutting production to accommodate others. OPEC's a cartel, and any cartel is designed with one purpose, to keep prices above equilibrium. Well, that encourages cheaters. Somebody wants more than their share, and it's OPEC members or within the cartel, or it's others like Russia or American frackers. So what happened is the Saudi led OPEC last, you say, November 27, 2014. That was Thanksgiving Day in America. We're all sitting down to our turkeys, and they decided they weren't going to cut because they said, well, every time we cut, somebody else moves in and grabs our market share. Enough is enough. And OPEC and the Saudis at that time had about $750 billion in foreign exchange reserves, and they said, we're going to play a game of chicken here. We're going to see who can take lower prices the longest. We're going to outlast these cheaters. Somebody's going to have to throw in the towel and cut production. It isn't going to be us. Well, in these circumstances, you know, when you're in a price war, and that's what it is, you say, where is that chicken out price? And this is the reason that over a year ago, I said we could get to $10 to $20 a barrel. The chicken out price is not the cost of meeting budgets. For the Saudis, that's $95 a barrel. Kuwait, it's $45. Venezuela, it's $160. It's all over the lot, but it's way above current price. No, that's not the point. And the price at which somebody chickens out isn't what they call the full cycle price. It isn't the cost of drilling a new oil well, putting in all the infrastructure, the pipes, the drilling costs, and so on. So no, no, no. When you're in a price war, it's the marginal cost. It's the cost of just getting the oil out of the well, out of the ground when the wells are drilled and the pipes are laid. It's like if you've ever seen a gas war, four gasoline stations on an intersection. One of them starts to cut prices and the other follow because they don't want to lose market share. And they keep going. Well, where do they stop? They don't stop at the full cost of running that gas station. They stop at the point when the price of gasoline they're selling you and me is at the cost they pay to get it off the tank truck, plus, of course, the required taxes. That's it. That's the marginal cost. And that's where you end up. And the marginal cost, and this is the basis of my forecast over a year ago, the marginal cost in the best producing areas, the Permian Basin in Texas and in the Middle East, is $10 to $20 a barrel. And we've seen tremendous productivity growth. It's probably even getting lower.
The Big Picture is a discussion today between Jim Poplava and Dr. Gary Schilling, who is author of The Age of Deleveraging and publisher of the newsletter Insight. We'll be back with this in just a moment as the Big Picture and Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Kurt Kalous joins us. He's the author of ExecSpec, a long-running advisory newsletter, and he's also the partner of a machine tool company. And Kurt, we spoke to you last time in November, and you had said that we're looking at a favorable seasonal time period for oil, but you weren't expecting a more sustainable bottom until this year in 2016. We definitely saw that take place. Oil, I think it maintained for a little bit after we had you on, and then we saw a deeper correction into January, and it looks like oil has temporarily bottomed out at $26 per barrel, and that was the low, and it's rallied over 20% since then to the $33 range, is now backing off. We've seen some poor factory data out of China, so the outlook for China continues to be a little bit dark there, and also we see continuing output from OPEC expanding, so the supply and demand fundamental backdrop for oil looks to be getting worse or has not yet improved. So let's start there. What are your thoughts on the oil market and some of the drivers that we see taking place?
Thanks again, Chris, for having me on. I would like to clarify also before we go into the oil forecast that when we talked in November, the area I was talking about was for a seasonal bottom in oil. Again, it was not necessarily meant to say that there's a strong period coming up here, just that markets should be negative with downward pressure into that December, January, possibly February time period before there's an inventory drawdown that typically takes place seasonally into that March, April, May time frame. So again, by March, I would guess that we will have some more upward sustainable pressures for the short term at that point. But the oil prices did rally from that, well, looking at the March contract of WTI, did rally from the just below 27 up to almost $35 a barrel, and now has dropped quite sharply over $2 a barrel today. That certainly is not unexpected, and potential for retesting below 30 seemed extremely likely to occur once that rally took place. There's no reason for inventories to start declining anytime soon. There's still too much production out there. That's the main driver. You simply have slowing growth rates in the world led by China and emerging markets, China being the second biggest economy in the world. And that certainly is a negative psychological as well as functional pressure on the demand side. And then supply side, while there is some curtailment production in the U.S., knocking out maybe 500,000 barrels a day of production, it's still not big enough. If you start knocking out 1 million to 2 million barrels a day, you know, that will raise some eyebrows and start to create more balance there. But you have Nigeria and Iraq and Iran certainly coming on with more production. Russia's hitting record numbers despite decaying oil fields. Saudi Arabia and most of the OPEC members have no choice but to keep production high. Venezuela can't even produce the light sweet crude that they want to. They have to import sweets to help their heavy sours to produce more oil there. But they want to produce as much as they can before they go bankrupt. So the supply and demand factors are still going in the wrong directions for oil. You have sluggish demand growth, and you've got still, you know, supply stability and possibly increases coming up there despite the shut-in of oil out of the U.S. and North American markets that is taking place as a trickle right now. And eventually that will increase the amount of oil that we produce over here that will be shut in. But it is challenging for that balance to occur, and that is a big risk for China and the global debt market.
Welcome back to the Big Picture today here on the Financial Sense News Hour, a special Big Picture with Jim Poplava, having a really fascinating discussion with Dr. Gary Schilling, author of The Age of Deleveraging, and Dr. Schilling's addressing the economic implications of continuing global deflation, as well as the de facto dissolution of OPEC. Here's Jim Poplava.
Let's talk about something that exists today that did not exist when OPEC was formed. In pretty much over the last couple of decades, we saw up until the fracking and horizontal drilling revolution was shale take place. U.S. production had fallen. It peaked in the early 70s. Then I think we were around 5 million barrels of production. So Western oil production was in decline, and some of the new sources of oil like offshore Brazil or deep water oil was very, very expensive to produce. Now, OPEC is dealing with Russia, which has been overproducing. They're dealing with U.S. shale producers, which they've been driving down with technology, the cost of oil. One of the things I think the Saudis were quite right in thinking, well, if we're the only ones that are going to cut production, we'll just cede market share to other countries, whether it's a Russia, now Iran coming online with oil, or U.S. shale producers. I guess OPEC now has what they didn't have before. They have competition.
Oh, yeah, they sure do. Again, something we just wrote up in our February newsletter was looking at OPEC as a cartel. And it started in 1960, and it had all the characteristics that make a cartel work. It had a relatively few members, so they could discipline it. They were the low-cost producer. There was no really alternative sources. They had the backing of their governments, which protected them. They had tremendous advantages. At that time, there was huge demand for oil. There was strong economic growth. They were in the driver's seat. And, of course, you look at it today, and it's very, very different. You have a weak global economy. Conservation has gotten to be important, of course, higher mileage requirements and so on. And, of course, the alternate sources of energy are just mushrooming, and particularly the American fracked oil. I mean, that's, in effect, the new source of global energy. And if you look at it, and again, one of the graphs we love to put in our newsletter simply shows OPEC and non-OPEC production going back about three decades. And if you go back until 10 years ago, OPEC production was increasing, and there wasn't much happening outside of OPEC. In the last 10 years, all the growth in world output has come outside of OPEC. OPEC production has been flat. And again, they earlier were cutting production to try to keep prices from collapsing. They were ceding market share to everybody else, and they finally said, hey, enough is enough.
It's not just that they have competition from, let's say, American producers or Russia or other sources of oil, but they're also getting competition from alternative sources of energy, whether, I mean, I just take a look at the cost of solar, how that's come down, the cost of wind energy. So there's also alternatives that are now competing against OPEC oil.
You know, that's interesting because they really killed their own goose that laid the golden egg. If you go back to the Arab oil embargo in 1973, and then the Iranian Revolution at the end of the decade, OPEC realized that they could raise prices almost without limit. And they did. I mean, prices went up four times in 1973 after the embargo, and they doubled again at the end of the decade. Well, these guys thought, hey, we got it made here. But what they didn't realize were two things. One is, as they raise prices, you get conservation. I mean, you know, you and I can remember when in the 1970s, 55 miles an hour was a driving limit, and everybody patriotically observed it. I mean, well, that was the way we were going to combat these guys. And the other thing they didn't realize was, of course, alternative energy being developed. And that's when we started to subsidize and still have to subsidize wind and solar and thermal and all these other kinds of energy. But they really killed themselves. Now, later on, they realized what was going on. They said, okay, we're going to produce enough oil to keep prices high, but not to encourage substitutes. But the cat was out of the bag. This whole idea of energy self-sufficiency was very much in vogue. And, of course, now in this country with fracked oil and natural gas, and natural gas is a great abundance as well, we are rapidly eliminating our dependence on imported energy.
Gary, how much further can this go on? Because we now have this year Iranian oil production coming on. That could be another 500,000 barrels. And even here in the U.S., even though we've seen a drop in drill count, a lot of these smaller producers have to keep producing oil because a lot of them are saddled with debt, and they need the cash flow to make their interest payments.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And again, if you look at this, where is the element price? It's when free cash flow disappears. In other words, it's when the marginal cost of production is exactly equal to the price. And until you get to that point, they have every incentive to not only keep producing, but to produce even more. Because the more they can produce, even at lower profits, the more revenue they're going to have as opposed to doing nothing to service their huge debts. So it is a situation where you have increased production in the face of declining prices. It sounds ironic, but it's very logical. And again, until you get down to that point where marginal cost is equal to the price, you're going to see that continue. And of course, you pointed out earlier, a year ago, people thought that the frackers were going to be forced to cut back quickly because they're very short-lived wells, and everybody rushed into energy. Prices rebounded a bit. But guess what? The frackers didn't cut back. They increased their production again. And of course, a lot of people lost a tremendous amount of money betting that energy was going to revive quickly.
It's almost like the perfect storm that we're seeing in energy. You have increased competition coming in from countries like Russia. You have increased production from U.S. shale, which can, since it's more of a market-driven economy rather than, let's say, a command-driven economy, if prices rise, that production can come right back online. You've got growing competition from alternative sources, whether it's wind, solar, nuclear, hydroelectric, ethanol. And then on top of that, you have weakening global demand. So how long can they keep this up? I mean, there were rumors a couple of weeks ago that the Russians were finally talking to the Saudis, which they've been reluctant to do. So is it possible, Gary, that we could see a precipitous drop, let's say with inventories building, we drop down to the low 20s or even into the teen figure that you talk about, that the Russians get together with other large producers and say, we need to do something here. We can't allow this to go further. Because I want to bring up something that I never thought I would see, which is the Saudis have gone through $100 billion of their foreign currency reserves, and they're talking about taking their state oil company and bringing it to public to raise money.
Yeah, they're starting to get squeezed. And of course, that's a geopolitical issue too, because the Saudis, the royal family, are Sunnis. And the oil producing area in the northeast of Saudi Arabia is Shiite. And, you know, these are two branches of Islam, but they hate each other dearly. And the Saudis basically buy off the population. The citizens don't work there. I mean, they all have government jobs, kind of no-show jobs. And the actual work is done by imported labor from India and Pakistan and so on. So they have to keep these subsidies. I mean, gasoline there, they just increase the price by 50%. It's 85 cents a gallon in Saudi Arabia. So they buy out the population with huge subsidies. Well, now they're getting pressed, and they have to cut back on these subsidies. So it creates geopolitical problems for them. But what are the odds of they're getting together? Well, the Saudis tried to get the Russians and everybody outside of OPEC together before that fateful decision, November 27, 2014. And the others didn't cooperate because they said, we aren't going to cut unless somebody else does. In other words, we're not going to lose market share. And of course, that's still a possibility, but I don't think it's going to happen. You never know. It could be a big surprise tomorrow. But of course, the new thing you pointed out earlier is Iran. Iran is now out from under the sanctions. They're going to immediately come out with 500,000 barrels a day. And you've got about 92 million barrels a day total global production. So it is a meaningful amount. Doesn't take an awful lot on the margin to force prices down. And they may be up to 1 million barrels a day within a year. And they've got a lot of oil in floating storage. In other words, they've got the biggest tanker fleet in the world right now. And the oil is just sitting there waiting to be delivered, particularly into Europe. The Saudis have been cutting prices in Europe in anticipation of cheaper Iranian oil. And of course, they hate each other dearly. The Iranians and the Saudis, they got a proxy war in Syria, a proxy war in Yemen. I think the odds that they're going to get together and go through massive cuts with Russia and with everybody else, and Russia's on the other side in Syria as well, I think that's a very low probability.
So, in your opinion, does OPEC effectively, maybe not formally or informally, dissolve because they haven't been able to control the price? They haven't been able to even stay within their own quotas. So as an organization, it's becoming less and less effective.
Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, part of this whole discussion of OPEC and oil in our February newsletter, we've actually reproduced a report that I did back in 1978. It was an op-ed page report for the Wall Street Journal, and it was a review of cartels going back to ancient Greek times. And it was really looking at how they were formed and what made them work and what didn't make them work. As I say, the kind of things I cited earlier that made OPEC work, having a stranglehold on the production of a key commodity, having a limited number of members of the cartel, no effective outside commissions, strong demand, all these things have historically made cartels work. And when do they fall apart? They fall apart when you get weak demand, when you get competition, when you get internal fighting, Iran and the Saudis right now, and when you get alternative sources of production. So it's really a classic pattern going back, you know, a few thousand years. There's nothing new. So I think OPEC as an effective cartel is pretty much finished.
Let's bring this back to the economy, investments, and let's talk as we begin our discussion. We talked about when you have large amounts of debt and you go through this deleveraging process, normally it takes about a decade. You think, where are we there 9 years? We could have another 6-8 years running. Let's talk about the implications for that, because the Federal Reserve raised interest rates in December. The futures market doesn't think they're going to go into March. The Fed is talking about raising interest rates, Gary, at a time when we don't have inflation going. We have 2% economic growth. So typically in the past, I think of when they started raising rates in the last decade, you had 3-5% inflation rates. You had an economy that was overheating, especially in the real estate sector. None of that exists today other than the fact that the unemployment rate has dropped, but there's no real wage growth. So let's bring this back to the Fed going forward. I mean, I just don't see how they could start raising interest rates. And, you know, they originally, their dot plot thought maybe 4 increases this year. I can't see them doing that, given what it's doing to the dollar, what's happening to profits, what's happening with the slowdown in Chinese economic growth. Europe is not much better, and even the slowdown here in the U.S.
Well, you're absolutely right. And by the way, you know, the Fed does have this dual mandate, price stability, which they define as 2% inflation, and it's basically zero, so they're way below that. And the other one is full employment. And yes, the unemployment rate has dropped from 10% in the Great Recession 2007-09 to 5%. But the reason it's come down is because people have dropped out of the labor force. Now, about 2/3 of those are retiring post-war babies, but the rest are people who just said, I can't find a job, or younger people said, I'll stay in college to get more education, I'll find a job. A lot of them have come out with no better job prospects, but huge student debts. But if you hadn't had these people dropping out of the labor force, the unemployment rate wouldn't be 5% now, it'd be 13%. And the Fed is well aware of this. The problem with the Fed is that they, like almost every other forecaster, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the vast majority of private forecasters, we've been one of the few who've been looking for this 2% growth. Everybody else has consistently in the last 6 years said the economy is going to pick up. You mentioned that at the outset. It's going to grow 3-4%. And of course, they keep saying this and it doesn't grow that. They keep saying we're going to raise interest rates because we're going to have an overheated economy. We're going to have inflation pick up. It's been quite the reverse. The Fed painted themselves into a corner. They really cried wolf so often. I think they had to raise rates last December or their credibility would have been shot. Well, now, you know, my thinking is that the next move of the Fed will probably be to reduce rates, not to increase them. Because if they had not gotten themselves into that position where they had cried wolf so often, I don't think they would have done anything last December. And of course, you have other major central banks, notably the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan, who are going quite the opposite. They're going hot and heavy with the quantitative easing that the Fed was engaged in until the end of 2014.
You see this age of deleveraging, as you wrote in your book, persisting for at least another 6-8 years. Gary, you're not a permabear or a pessimist. Let's talk about the optimistic side. What happens, in your opinion, because you have a lot of Malthusians out there that are talking about aging demographics. I even read an article last week that they're talking about 2% or less economic growth is the new norm that could be with us for the rest of the 21st century. You don't see things going that way. In other words, once this deleveraging process plays itself out, then you see economic growth picking up. And let's talk about some of the reasons you believe that and what will be driving it.
That's true. And an interesting point here is that when you see a phenomenon last for some time, in this case, slow growth for now 9 years, it's very easy to forecast it lasting forever. The audience out there is ready to say, right on, brother, that's what I see. And so you have these Malthusians. You've got Bob Gordon, professor at Northwestern, who says everything that's invented can be invented that's going to move the productivity needle has been invented. And you got guys like Larry Summers who are saying, you know, we've got a permanent slow growth. A labor force is growing slowly. Productivity is growing slowly. It's never going to get out of here. What you were saying, you know, indefinite slow growth. Well, I'm the type of guy, when the herd is going one way, I always want to look at it and say, maybe it's about time things may go the other way. And that's a position I've taken. We've written articles in the last couple of years on this, saying that we think that when this age of deleveraging is over, we will resume rapid growth. And the principal reason is because I think many of the technologies that we have today are not mature, as these Malthusians would say, but they're really more in their infancy. You look at your cell phone. My goodness gracious, you know, a few years ago, who would have thought that the power of that cell phone, you know, who needs a camera? Who needs a calculator? All this stuff lugged around in our pockets. Forget about it. And, you know, the power of that thing, I think, is still in its infancy. And the same is with robotics and with additive manufacturing. And, you know, I think it's a whole host of new technologies. The interesting thing about historically is that new technologies grow like topsy when they are started, but it takes a long time for them to get big enough to move the economy because they're starting at zero. Give you an example. The American Industrial Revolution, that started in New England as well as England in the late 1700s. But it wasn't until after World War II that it became big enough to really move the economy. The same with railroads. Railroads were invented in the late 1700s. And again, it was only after the Civil War that they became big enough to dominate the economy and push it. And I think that's the same through with what we have today in terms of new technology. So I'm firmly of the conviction that once we get through this age of deleveraging, we're going to see a resumption of rapid growth and then probably even very strong growth, maybe up to about 4% for a few years on a catch-up basis.
I want to talk about two things that are, I think, game changers, and you and I have had this discussion on the past, and that is what is going to occur and is occurring now in education, because the old paradigm, Gary, for many listeners to this show is, you know, junior went to high school and then he graduated from high school, was shipped off to a college, lived in a dorm, and got out of college and had a great paying job. You take a look at that paradigm, you take a look at the massive amount of debt, as we discussed earlier, with average millennials bringing anywhere from $70,000 or more of debt into a marriage. In your January insight, you talk about this higher education environment is moving to four models. One, you've got the top institutions like your Harvards, your MITs, Stanfords. They're well-financed, well-endowed. They'll be there with students getting maybe specific majors. Then you'll have the mid-tier schools that you believe are going to have to start switching to what you call STEM, S-T-E-M, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. That's the second model. The third is inexpensive online courses. And we're seeing this with the millennials, Gary, that junior stays at home, maybe gets a job instead of amassing debt, gets a job, gets work experience, and maybe attends an online university at night. And number four, something I've seen, which is a lot of these companies, whether it's General Electric or Apple, they team up with a local junior college. Maybe they have a two-year program where students are going through an apprentice program. Reminds me of the old guilds they had in the 14th century, where they learned to become mechanics, operators of very sophisticated computerized equipment, which is what we're seeing on the factory floor. Let's talk about that, because this has broad implications for not only debt accumulation, but also for future growth in this economy.
I think it does. And of course, one of the interesting things is, I think, a confusion of causality with statistics. You know, you cannot prove causality with statistics. I guarantee you, every time there's a total of eclipse of the sun, if we go outside and beat a drum, it will go away. 100% correlation, but no causality. I think the same is true with education. People with a college education make more money than people with a high school education. Statistics are clear. But I think it's because smart people go to college, not because college makes you smart. Now, of course, a lot of people thought that college did make you smart. And what did we have? We had this proliferation of these for-profit colleges, which have been an absolute disaster. They were feeding off of government subsidies. They turn out people who are virtually no education, huge debts. They've been an absolute disaster. But that was because they said people with any brain power thought, if I go to college, I'm going to make a lot of money. Well, you know, smart people go to college, but college doesn't make you smart. And this four-tier structure that I've been advocating, and you outlined beautifully there, I think that is going to get away from that kind of feeling. And we're going to have a lot more people, particularly in this final category, who have a lot of ability to make good incomes. I mean, there's something like 600,000 jobs in people that can run computers and so on and so forth. And these guys are making, you know, they're making close to six figures in a lot of cases, but they're not college grads. They're people with two-year associate's degree and a strong apprenticeship program. The Germans brought that with them, that tradition. They brought it with them to the Southeast when they moved a lot of manufacturing companies to the Southeast in this country. And then the American companies, and you mentioned a couple of them, have emulated that. But I think that's the most exciting development in education. And again, it's going to be different because you got the top tier. Yeah, they're fine. They're in great shape. The second tier, they're going to have to prove to students and their parents that that money they're spending is well spent. And I'm afraid, you know, in STEM, it's going to be more, I wouldn't call it a glorified trade school, but it's getting away from, you know, classic education, the training of the mind, more toward marketable skills and professions. You know, that's a whole debated point the academics have been at for centuries. But I do think that we are going to see this restructuring, and people are more and more going to realize that just getting a college degree doesn't guarantee them either a lot of income or a very interesting life either.
Well, let's sort of sum this up in terms of long-term investment themes. You believe, number one, commodities are in a long-term bear market, whether it's oil or another commodity. The dollar should probably continue to rise. You would be avoiding emerging markets. And if you were in equities, you would be defensive. Things like consumer staples and utilities, things that are predictable. And Gary, I know you changed my thinking in the early 80s when I read your book about deflation coming out of a high inflationary environment. You believe the bond rally of a lifetime still has some life to it.
Yeah, that's right. Because you look at treasuries, and again, in 1981, I said we're entering the bond rally of a lifetime because I saw inflation unwinding. And the yield on 30-year treasuries of 15.21%. Now it's below 3%. And that is actually, since the early 80s, because of its decline in interest rates, appreciation. And I've never bought treasuries in the accounts that we manage, and we do manage money. I've never bought them for yield. I couldn't care less what the yield is as long as it's going down, because when the yield goes down, the price goes up. And actually, since the early 80s, long treasuries have beat the S&P 500 by six times. You've made six times as much money investing in long treasuries as in the S&P 500. Now, I think we've got further to go here in this bond rally of a lifetime, further decline in interest rates. Why? Well, first of all, we've got low inflation and really more likelihood of deflation than not. Secondly, treasuries are a safe haven. It's like the dollar. That's where people go in the world when there's uncertainty. And a third thing is that treasury yields are higher in this country than the comparable yields in almost any other developed country. I mean, you've got 10-year government debt in Germany, which is virtually flat. In this country, it's about 1.8%. Well, that means that somebody in Germany can buy a U.S. Treasury, get a higher yield, and with the dollar appreciating versus the euro currency, they're going to make money when they look at it in euro terms as well. So it's a double whammy. And by the way, if you have that decline from where we are now to 2% on treasuries, and particularly if you look at it in terms of zero coupon treasuries, you've got about another 25% appreciation in them. It doesn't sound like very much to go from, you know, a little less than 3% to 2%. But again, because the way it works, it would give you about a 25% appreciation.
So, Gary, if I was to sum up here, you think, as you wrote in the book, The Age of Deleveraging, this deleveraging process probably has another 6 to 8 years to play out, which means that the 2% economic growth that you forecast is more of the norm that we're more likely to see going forward, despite the blustering promises made by our politicians. That's a factor. The second is, given where energy is today, the multiple different sources of competition, whether it's alternatives or alternative producers, that OPEC's days as a driving force behind the price of oil are over. And also, much like Japan, China is much more likely to age before it becomes rich. So in terms of China dominating the world and becoming a superpower, that is not likely.
No. And by the way, one of the interesting things with this continuing slow growth is causing a tremendous amount of frustration among voters throughout the U.S. and Europe. And you see that frustration exhibited by people, as you pointed, they're turning their backs on the sort of the mainstream centrist politicians. They're going for the extremes. In France, they have this National Front far right party. The new head of the Labour Party in England is far left. In this country, we got, in the Republican Party, we got Trump, and Democrats, they got Bernie. These extremes. In other words, there was a movie years ago called Network, you might remember, when this guy goes to the window, throws it open, and yells, "I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore." And I think that's what's happening to voters in Europe and the U.S. They are looking for alternatives. And what we've been writing about in this is we think that this may end up as a big push for more fiscal stimulus. Monetary policy doesn't work. We talked about that earlier. But I think we may see a lot of pressure. And one of the things in this country that may be agreed on, both the Democrats and Republicans, is infrastructure spending. You know, tax cuts are tough. The Democrats don't like the idea of cutting taxes on people on the top of the income, but, you know, 52% of people don't pay any income tax. You want to cut taxes, you got to cut the upper end, and those people probably wouldn't spend that much of the money anymore than they do when their portfolios go up. And the Republicans, a negative income tax, they're not all that hot for that either. But infrastructure spending, they might agree on, and we certainly could use a lot better roads and bridges and tunnels and everything else. And that may be something where there is a compromise. And we're far enough away from those $1 trillion deficits now that I think that their shock value is wearing off. So that's one of the things we're looking for. And I think it'll be interesting to see how the election shapes up between now and the first Tuesday in November, to pick a random date, to see if this does winnow out to the point that there is, in effect, a voter pressure to do something, and it turns out to be fiscal stimulus and perhaps big infrastructure programs.
Well, Gary, as we conclude, if our listeners would like to find out more about your monthly newsletter, Insight, just like its name, tremendous thought-provoking thoughts with a lot of detail behind. You just don't make forecasts. You back it up with facts. How can they find out more or get information about your newsletter?
Well, they can go to our website. It's www.agaryschilling.com. If somebody's interested in a sample copy of our newsletter, we could send them one. We do have a toll-free number, 888-346-7444. 888-346-7444.
I've been following you and reading your books, Gary, going back to the early 80s when I began my career, very influential because you got me off the inflation wave that was in vogue very much when I got in the industry in the early part of the 80s. My compliments to your insights. Gary, thank you so much for joining us on the program, and all the best to you, sir.
Well, my pleasure. I always enjoy these interviews. You do your homework and you ask great questions. Thanks.
Well, coming up in the very near future, we have Fed Chair's Janet Yellen's testimony on Capitol Hill, and we're still making our way through earnings season. Anything else I have missed on the horizon other than an incoming comet that nobody ever noticed?
Can't think of anything outside a meteor shower or anything like that. I guess the real big thing is going to be Yellen's testimony on Capitol Hill, because, I mean, we just keep getting a series of weakening economic data, not only here, but overseas. And people are going to say, hey, guys, you know, it's like Craig said, they probably aren't going to take it back because their credibility is at stake here. But is it going to be one and shut up? And already we've had a divergence of opinions. We've had a couple Fed governors coming out there, no, we're proceeding, we're going to be raising rates. And a couple others are sort of moving more towards that dovish, hawkish side. So everybody's going to kind of look for every little nuance, and you'll have 2 days of them on Capitol Hill. So everybody's going to pay a close attention to that, especially with the continuous weak economic data that we've been getting. All that in the weeks ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.